I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is writer Andrew Solomon, whose new book is Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. And now join Warren Browner on stage at the JCCSF as he introduces Andrew Solomon.
Thank you and welcome. There are really two perks to being the president of the board here. One is I get a free parking pass. But the more important one is when I come across something interesting, I can call Lenore or Barbara Lane and say, hey, we need to get this person here into one of our programs. And that's exactly what happened with Andrew Solomon and his absolutely magnificent book, Far From the Tree. Probably 5 pages into it when I realized we absolutely needed to have this man come talk to us here in San Francisco. And we needed to have him do it here at the JCC. If you look outside, you'll notice that one of our tenets is welcoming strangers. And I think this book is about opening our hearts to people who are different. It is an incredibly brave and beautifully written book, but be prepared to be up late into the night because it carries you along in a narrative that is truly thrilling and deeply insightful. So we're going to begin with a brief video to introduce tonight's topic. So if we could have the video.
When I was born deaf, my mother cried. She really did not see a future.
The doctor said he would never amount to anything. His mental capacity would be little to none. And you should probably give him up and think about adoption.
I didn't know the word transsexual. The word transgender hadn't even been invented yet.
Chris probably had one of the worst diagnoses ever. Self-injurious, mental retardation, severe autism. And I was pretty much told to put him in an institution.
You sort of get what you get, and you go from there.
I thought to myself, if he's happy, if he stops hurting himself, you know, if I could hug him, that would be the greatest gift in life.
I'm lucky to have had her in this particular period of time. Thank you.
God gave me a brain, and he gave me a heart. I try to use both of those things to the fullest.
There really isn't any definition of what's normal or not normal or far from the tree or right under the tree. The love that parents have for their children can see them through an enormous amount.
It's my pleasure to introduce Andrew Solomon, who writes about how parents love children even when they fall far from the tree. Andrew.
Thank you all for coming tonight. Even in purely non-religious terms, homosexuality represents a misuse of the sexual faculty. It is a pathetic little second-rate substitute for reality, a pitiable flight from life. As such, it deserves no glamorization, no rationalization, and above all, no pretense that it is anything but a pernicious sickness. That's Time magazine in 1966, when I was 3 years old. And in the course of the last year, both the President of the United States and the Supreme Court have expressed support for gay marriage. And I set out to write my book to examine how that had come to pass. How was it that an illness, something generally accepted as an illness, had come to be an identity? What was the meaning of that shift, and what other conditions might follow in its footsteps? When I was perhaps 6 years old, I went with my mother and my brother to a shoe store in New York. It was called Indian Walk Shoes, which I think is a name that would not go down very well today, but it did then. When we had finished getting our shoes fitted, we were told by the salesman that each of us could have a balloon to take home. And my brother wanted a red balloon, and I wanted a pink balloon. And my mother said she thought I would really rather have a blue balloon. And I said, no, I really wanted the pink balloon. And she reminded me that my favorite color was blue. The fact that my favorite color now is blue, but I'm still gay, should give you some sense of my mother's influence and its limits. As I was growing up, she used to say all the time, the love you have for your children is like no other feeling in the world. And until you have children, you don't know what it feels like. And when I was little and she said that, I took it as the greatest compliment. It meant that bringing up my brother and me was the great joy of her life. And when I was a little older, it made me anxious. I thought, but I'm gay, and if I'm gay, I probably can't have children. And what is it that I'm going to be missing? And when I came out and she continued to say it, it made me angry. And I said, you know that's not the path that I'm on, and I want you to stop saying that. But she never did stop saying it, and I never stopped hearing it. About 20 years ago, my editors at the New York Times Magazine asked me to write an article about deaf culture. And I was very taken aback at the time. I thought of deafness as a sad tragedy for people who couldn't hear. I had had no exposure to anything that would qualify as deaf culture. I thought it was simply a disability a difficult one at that. And then I went out into the deaf world. The first person I met was Jackie Roth, the deaf woman who you saw briefly in the video just now. I got to know Jackie. I got to know the deaf world. I went to the deaf theater. I went to deaf clubs. I went to houses where the alarm clock was a flashing light and where the household pets understood sign language. I got very deep into this world. I even went to the Miss Deaf America contest in Nashville, Tennessee, where people complained about that slurry southern signing. And as I threw myself deeper and deeper into the deaf world, I became persuaded that it was a culture. Not only that it was a culture, but that it was in some senses a very alluring culture. There were times when I was with deaf people in deaf contexts, and I wished that I were deaf. Not that I wished I couldn't hear, but that I wished I were part of that community that they were part of. I wished that I could understand all of what was going on in a room full of flying hands. I wished for the particular intimacies connected to deafness. And then I discovered that most deaf children are born to hearing parents, that those parents have historically tried to get them to function as well as possible in the hearing world and have devoted huge amounts of energy to teaching lip reading and oral speech, which are very difficult for people who are deaf to acquire with any real fluency. And that a lot of the time, those deaf people had discovered deaf culture in adolescence or thereafter when it came to them as a great and glorious liberation. And I thought how similar that experience was to the experience of gay people who are the children of straight parents, who have to go out into a world and discover a cultural identity, often in adolescence or later, and for whom also it can come as a glorious liberation. And then a friend of mine had a daughter who was a dwarf, and she began talking about the question she faced. Should she tell her daughter she was the same as everyone else but shorter, or should she somehow help her to construct a sense of dwarf identity? And as she went on about that very question, I found myself thinking, here it is again. Here it is again, a family that perceives itself to be normal with a child whom they deem extraordinary in some way, and they don't know what to do with the identity issues that are attached. And I thought, if I found common cause with the deaf, and I find common cause with this little dwarf girl I've just heard about, who else is there out there who's in this same position? What is the gladsome throng waiting all to find one another and be united? And I came up with the idea that there are really two kinds of identities. There are vertical identities, which are passed down generationally, parent to child. So one's ethnicity, one's nationality, often one's religion, usually one's language. These are things that parents and children have in common. And even if sometimes those identities are very difficult, nobody tries to cure them. You can argue that in the United States, as it's currently constructed, it's actually harder to be a person of color than it is to be Caucasian. but nobody is doing research on ensuring that the next generation of children born to Asian or African American or Latino parents come out with blonde hair and blue eyes. But there are also what I called horizontal identities, identities which you learn not from your parents, but from your peer group, being gay, being deaf, being autistic, being a prodigy, being schizophrenic, being transgender. There's a whole group of them that I looked at. And these are all identities that you are learning horizontally from your peer group, and they're very different in character because time out of mind, people have tried to cure them or eliminate them or suppress them because they cause the parents who have these children who are different and alien so much fear and so much anxiety. As I looked at this question of horizontal identities and formulated the idea that I had grown up with a horizontal identity myself, I also came to recognize a distinction which had previously been obscure to me, and that's the distinction between love and acceptance. It took my parents some time to accept me for who I was, though they got there in the end, and I think that I experienced those deficits in acceptance as deficits in love. And now I think that they loved me all along, and that acceptance takes time. It took all of the families I talked to a certain amount of time. Love is something that ideally is there from the time the baby is born. And acceptance of who the child really is something that's arrived at very gradually. And the conflict of parenthood, the sort of dichotomy of parenthood in a way, is that parents have two responsibilities. The first responsibility is to change our children. We don't let children grow up in a state of nature. We educate them. We teach them manners. We show them the rules of basic hygiene. We try to instill values in them. That's the responsibility of a parent, and people who don't do it are neglectful. But parents need also to accept their children for who they are and to find a means to celebrate them for who they are. And what is sometimes difficult to figure out is which traits need to be modified through education and other interventions and which traits need to be accepted. Some things clearly need to be accepted, some things clearly need to be changed, but a lot falls in that confused middle. When I was a child, I was diagnosed with severe dyslexia. And my parents were told that I would never learn to read or write, and I was turned down by all of the elementary schools that I had applied to in first grade. I've had many problems in life, and that isn't one of them. But my mother worked very closely with me and was able to resolve the dyslexia, and I'm very grateful that she did. And then I think that set the stage for her hope at a later stage that we could resolve the homosexuality, which was a less successful undertaking. As parents recognize the qualities in their children which turn out not to be mutable, the ones that can't be educated away, there are a number of responses. Some parents are outraged by these experiences. Some parents are bewildered. Some parents are celebratory. Most parents have moments of each of those sensations and gradually move from one to the next. So let me tell you about a few of the people I interviewed as I worked on this book. Clinton Brown is the dwarf you saw in the video. He's someone who I got to know very well. When he was born, he was diagnosed with diastrophic dwarfism, which is an extremely disabling condition, and his parents were essentially told that he would never function in any domain and that they should leave him to die quietly at the hospital. And instead, his mother decided that she was going to take him home. And though she didn't have vast educational or economic resources, she decided that she was going to figure out how to take care of this child. And she found her way in a pre-internet era to the doctor at Johns Hopkins, who was the leading surgeon dealing with children with conditions like this. And that doctor, Stanley Kopetz, took Clinton on as a patient. And in the course of his childhood, he had 30 major surgeries, as a result of which he actually now can walk. And while he was stuck in the hospital having all of these procedures, he decided there wasn't anything else much to do, and so he might as well focus on his schoolwork. And so that's what he did, and he ended up having academic achievements beyond anything that had previously existed in his family, and being among the first in his family to go on to college. And he went to a university that wasn't very far from where his parents live, and he had learned to drive and had a specially fitted car that he could drive, which had all kinds of adaptations. So his mother called me one day and she said, "I was driving home from shopping today and I went past a bar and there was Clinton's car parked outside a bar." And I thought to myself, oh my God, he's 3 feet tall, they're 6 feet tall, 2 beers for them is 4 beers for him. She said, and I wanted to go in there and interrupt what was going on. And then I thought I couldn't do that, so I just went home and left him 11 messages on his voicemail. She said, and then I thought, if someone had told me when he was born that my future worry would be that he would go drinking and driving with his college buddies, I would have been so thrilled to have that problem. And I said to her, what do you think you did that helped him to emerge as such an extraordinary person, so articulate, so charming, popular, accomplished, given that dire prognosis that you had when he was born? What did you do? And she said to me, what did we do? We loved him, that's all. Clinton just always had that light in him, and we were lucky enough to be the first to see it there. Another one of the dwarfs I got to know very well, who also has a disabling dwarfing condition. There are many dwarfing conditions that are less disabling. But Kiki Peck has something called Kniest's syndrome. And her mother described how she had been conformist and wanted to look like everyone else and wanted to be like everyone else, and how she then had this daughter who was so very different, and how she had to give up all of those prejudices and anxieties, and how in awe she was of her daughter's ability to function in the world with the great differences that she had. Kniest dysplasia affects cartilage, so she has very arthritic joints, she has compromised vision, she has lack of cartilage in some of her facial features. It's a difficult, difficult condition, and yet Kiki has a certain joyful quality. And her mother said to me, I think of the word brave, how I have to say it as a mantra. One beat, one syllable. She is more brave than I. When Kiki was 9, her mother was diagnosed with breast cancer and told that she would have to undergo chemotherapy. And so she told her children that she was going to shave her head in advance of doing it. And Kiki said, I'll help you shave your head. So her mother said, okay. So Kiki helped her shave her head. And then she said, and now I'm going to shave my head. And her mother said, no, what are you talking about? Of course you're not. Why would you do that? And she said, I've spent so much time being different on my own, so I know how hard it is, and I'd like you to have someone else to be different with you and for you not to be different by yourself. And so there was a story. As with Clinton, these were people who had achieved not only despite their disability, but in some sense because of it. Clinton, because he had decided to use all that time when he was stuck in the hospital, and Kiki, because of this extraordinary emotional growth and maturity and compassion that had been the result of her own experience of difficulty in the context of a loving family. I'm going to quote to you from one other magazine of the 1960s. This is the Atlantic Monthly, A Voice of Liberal America in 1968. There is no reason to feel guilty about putting a Down syndrome child away, whether it is put away in the sense of hidden in a sanitarium or in a more responsible, lethal sense. It is sad, yes, dreadful, but it carries no guilt. True guilt arises only from an offense against a person, and a Downs is not a person. We hear that these days and are shocked by it. It's difficult to remember that 50 years ago, that's the way that people thought about Down syndrome. There's been a great deal of press given to the shift in gay rights, to the transformation, indeed, of our understanding of what it means to be gay. But in a way, we've paid less attention to the way that our understanding of difference altogether has shifted. The shift has been profound and dramatic. All of us are horrified to hear those words today. All of us recognize in them a tragedy of prejudice that has been to some degree resolved. And now people with Down syndrome live 3 times as long as they did in 1968. And they accomplish at a level that was previously unimaginable. Some of them are writers. Some of them are actors. Some live largely independently. The level of functioning has been changed through educational initiatives.
You're listening to writer Andrew Solomon, whose new book is Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
One of the families I got to know who had a child with Down syndrome were Tom and Karen Robards in New York, who were hard-charging Wall Street types when their son was born. They were shocked that he had this condition. They were unsatisfied with the educational opportunities available to him, so they banded together with two other families and decided to get someone in to tutor their children a little bit in hopes that they could be reached. And they got the Archdiocese of New York to lend them an unused lavatory that they converted into a classroom. And so they began something which has since grown into the Cook Center, which helped to establish some of those educational programs that have transformed the lives of people with Down syndrome. And the Cook Center has now educated untold thousands of people with intellectual disabilities. And I said to them, because they have devoted their lives to doing this, I said, do you regret it? Do you wish your son didn't have Down syndrome? Do you wish you could make it go away? And Tom said, well, for David, their son, he said, for David, I wish I could make it go away, because for David, it's a difficult way to be in the world, and I would like to give him an easier life. He said, but I think if we lost all the people with Down syndrome from the world population, it would be a real loss to humanity. So the personal wish and the social wish are in opposition. And his mother, Karen, said, David's mother, Karen, said, she said, I'm with Tom that I would make it go away for David if I could, because I really would like to make things easier for David. She said, but speaking for myself, I've become so much deeper a person. I've been so much more engaged. I've done so much more in the world than I would ever have done otherwise. She said, speaking for myself, though I would never have believed 23 years ago when our son was born, I could come to this point I have. For him, I would cure it in an instant, but for myself, I wouldn't give up these experiences for anything in the world. And I was very struck by those feelings, by that conflicting feeling of wanting to help, wanting to make his life better, and yet being so deeply engaged. And I was struck by the depth of love that these parents felt for their child and by the depth of purpose that was attached to being part of this social transformation. Someone who worked with people with Down syndrome and had done so for many years described to me being out with the man with Down syndrome who appears in the cast of Glee. And she said they were sitting at a restaurant and eating, and people were coming over to get his autograph. And she said, he was a celebrity first and a person with a disability second. I never dreamed I would see such a day. So those shifts have been enormous. Now, we live in a moment when we have all of the social progress that I've just described, but we also live in a moment of medical progress. The cochlear implant can take almost any form of deafness, not all, but almost any form of deafness, and allow, it's a technological device that gets implanted and is attached to a transmitter, and it allows sound information to bypass the structures of the ear and go directly to the sound centers in the brain. It can effectively make children who are born deaf able to function in and live in the hearing world and develop full oral speech. There is a new compound which has been tested in mice called BMN-111. It's used for blocking the action of the achondroplasia gene. That's the most common form of dwarfism, achondroplasia. In mice with the achondroplasia gene who have been given BMN-111, the gene is completely blocked and they grow to full height. The compound is now being tested in human beings. It could eliminate most of dwarfism. And in the world of Down syndrome, blood tests to pick up Down syndrome and other genetic abnormalities earlier and earlier in pregnancy are closer and closer to being viable and would allow people who wish to do so to terminate those pregnancies at an earlier and earlier stage. And I'm a great believer in medical progress, and I'm a great believer in social progress, and I'm frustrated some of the time by the way they seem not to notice each other, by the curious way that they seem to have collided, sort of like the end of a grand opera in which the hero realizes he loves the heroine at the exact moment that she lies expiring on the sofa. And I think we have to be aware of what the social progress is that makes us accept difference and what the medical progress is which may cause us to narrow the range of difference in human experience. I don't have a strong view as to what's right or wrong. I only have a sense that it's an important thing to notice. Jacob Schamberg, who's someone with deafness who I spent a lot of time with, and who helped me, in fact, with some of the research in the deaf community for my book, said to me, while I'm pretty comfortable with my disability and don't see cochlear implant as an evil force intent on destroying deaf culture, I do get a sense of impending extinction. There will always be deaf people worldwide, but there is a real possibility that it'll be near eradicated in the developed world within 50 to 100 years. I say near because there will always be immigrants, untreatable conditions, cultural holdouts, and so on. But no more people like me. And I thought there was so much loneliness in that phrase, no more people like me. And as I listened to it, I thought what it would be like if someone were to develop a treatment that meant that nobody had to be gay anymore. How many families would go for that? How far have we really progressed with a battle for gay rights? Would parents make that decision on behalf of their children on grounds that it would give them an easier life? They probably would. And would it give those children an easier life? It might give them an easier life. I certainly would have had an easier life if I hadn't dealt with being gay when I was growing up. Would it have been a better life? I'm perhaps delusionally committed to the idea that it would not necessarily have been a better life. So that's a real question. And the question of cure, I found, pervaded all of the conversations I had in these arenas. So Jim Sinclair, who is an autism activist, said he's been very vociferous about the idea that autism is so deeply braided into the fabric of one's consciousness that it can't be separated out. And he's opposed what's called person-first terminology in disability. It is considered politically correct and polite to say a person with Down syndrome and not a Down syndrome person, to say a person with schizophrenia and not say a schizophrenic. Those are the more polite modes of address and explanation. Jim Sinclair said, calling me a person with autism is like calling me a person with maleness. I'm not a person with maleness, I'm a man. And I'm not a person with autism, I'm an autistic. And he wrote, when parents say, I wish my child did not have autism, what they're really saying is, I wish the autistic child I have did not exist, and I had a different, non-autistic child instead. Read that again. This is what we hear when you mourn over our existence. This is what we know when you pray for a cure, that your fondest wish is that someday we will cease to be, and strangers you can love will move in behind our faces. Now, that's a very extreme point of view, and autism is particularly complicated because it has an extremely vigorous autism rights movement, of which Jim Sinclair is an important exponent. But autism describes a range of people that includes people who live not very far from here and run the tech industry, on the one hand, and children who are sitting in a corner banging their heads against the wall with no language and apparently in a state of great pain and destruction. But I go back to the idea that one is considering always in parenting what things to change and what things to accept. The mother of one of the people with autism with whom I spent a lot of time had a daughter who's spoken four times in her life. And each time what she said has been appropriate to the circumstances. When she was six, having never said a word, she was sitting one day with her parents and her mother turned off the TV and she said, I want the television on. And then she said nothing else for three more years. And then at one point her mother came in and turned off the lights. And she said, who turned the lights off? And four times in the course of her life at the age of 17, she's come out with a perfectly coherent sentence. Well, if you have a child who's never spoken at all, you may assume rightly or wrongly that that child perhaps doesn't understand what's going on linguistically, doesn't have self-awareness and self-consciousness. But if someone has spoken four times, there's that constant question of what's really going on in there and why the speech could come through on those occasions and whether, if you did something right, it could come through more often. And a whole web of questions that are around that. But that's been the situation, and the child is now in late adolescence, and her mother said about her, Cece is the Zen lesson. Why does Cece have autism? Because Cece has autism. And what is it like to be Cece? Being Cece, because no one else is, and will never know what it's like. It is what it is. It isn't anything else. And maybe you'll never change it, and maybe you should stop trying. That acceptance was very compelling to me, and I found echoes of it over and over again. Susan Weinreich, who has schizophrenia, described to me years that she spent in the grip of psychosis before she was finally brought in for good treatment and eventually turned out to be very responsive and made a quite extraordinary recovery. And she talked about the gradual reemergence of her personality after a really dire period when she had a delusion that she was a surgeon and she was trying to cut the devil out of herself by cutting and burning herself when she had been doing all kinds of extraordinarily destructive things, believed that there were terrible conspiracies, so on and so forth. And she then described finally getting into a hospital where she received good treatment. And she said, "I remember the first time I felt love after all that. I don't even remember who it was. Probably my therapist. I don't remember it being ecstatic. I just remember it feeling like when I would go fishing as a young girl and a sunfish would catch the hook. Just that tug on the other end of the line. After all those years of being so isolated within myself and so disconnected, the medication sucked out some of the symptoms. And as the psychosis receded, it left room for my heart to grow." Now, she ended up actually becoming someone who spoke publicly about her experience with mental illness in an attempt to fight the pervasive stigma that there is, especially around schizophrenia. And her mother described going to a dinner in Grand Central Station that was a mental health dinner at which Susan spoke. And this is what her mother said to me. She said, "I couldn't believe it. There were like 300 people there. And this is Susan. I mean, how did this happen?" She's definitely a stronger person than I've ever been. What saved her? It was her art. It was her doctor. It was the support from her brothers and me. But most of all, it was Susan. There was something in Susan that always wanted to come to the surface. I feel really bad that she had to go through what she went through. But I also recognize that if she hadn't, she wouldn't be who she is today. And who she is today is the most wonderful, charming, beautiful woman. I was very struck by these assertions over and over again of purposefulness, of parents who were attached to the children they had in the condition that those children were in. And I was struck by the courage with which those parents often had to fight for those children. I was struck by many of the decisions that those parents had to make. And I was struck by a world that is actually very mixed in its response to difference. In some instances, so very embracing and supportive, and in other instances, so prejudiced and cruel. And I felt in a way that the nature of that opposition was summed up in two stories of families who had children who were transgender, whom I interviewed. The first I'll tell you about is a woman named Anne O'Hara, who was living in a small town in Tennessee where she was the special education teacher at the school. And she had a child who was brought into the classroom who at the age of 6 didn't seem to have any language and seemed very chaotic and terribly behind. But she was told that this child's mother had severe mental illness and instead of taking her medication had fed it to her children to sedate them and had kept her 3 children tied to a pole so that they couldn't go anywhere and that they had finally been rescued by social services. And she said, "I'm not going to believe that there's anything else wrong with this child until we've worked through all of that." And she worked with this child. She got him to say his first word about 6 weeks after he came into her classroom. She gradually helped him to move forward. And then she was told he would be being removed because the 3 children, they hadn't found anyone who would take all 3 of them, and they were being sent to 3 different parts of the state. And she said, "Those children, the only continuity they have is one another, and I will take them, and I will adopt all 3 children." And that's what she did. And over the years, they all developed language, and they all moved out of special education. And one turned out to have childhood bipolar disorder and was medicated and treated for that. And one turned out to have ADHD and was medicated and treated for that. And the other one just seemed like a sad, sad little boy, small and sort of meek and quiet and withdrawn, and she never felt she could really get through to him. And one day they were sitting around and he said, "Mom, you know that I'm really a girl, that I've always really been a girl. How could you not have known all this time? I can't do it anymore. I can't keep living as a boy." And she had no experience with any of this, and she was very taken aback, and she said, "Well, look, I don't know what you're talking about, but, you know, you are a boy." They went through all of the sort of obvious things. Finally, she said to him, after she'd done some research and learned a certain amount, she said, "Look, finish out the school year as a boy, and I will let you try to live as a girl for 1 week this summer, and we'll see how it goes for you, and then we can discuss it. So he finished the school year and then began to live as a girl in the beginning of the summer and went from being this morose, sad little boy to being an exuberant, joyful little girl who bounced around, who was so excited about her lip gloss that her mother said she wanted to throw it away, who was just full of joy. And so Anne went into the school where she had taught all of the disabled and special needs children of this town for many, many years at that point. And she told the headmaster that in the fall, her son Kerry would be returning as a girl named Kelly, and explained what that meant and provided a book about transgender children and went home. And by the time she got back to her house, her cell phone had started ringing. It had started ringing with the local people of the local Baptist church and of the Ku Klux Klan in that area. They said that they would take that child and make her a woman if that's what she thought she was. They said they would kill Anne. They said they would kill the child. They said they would do all of these things. And Anne was completely shocked. She said she's the smallest kid in her class. She's a little girl. She said, what harm was she to anyone? The next day, her pediatrician called her and said, people are not talking about whether to kill your child. They're talking about when to do it and what they'll use for that purpose. And if you want that child to live to see a next birthday, you'd better get her out of town pretty fast. So Anne took her children and she piled them into her van and she left. And her husband stayed so that he would have work and health insurance so that they had something to live on. And she took the children and she left her town and she never was able to return. The day after she left, her husband came home from work and found their family dog disemboweled and nailed to the fence in front of their house with the message that their child, if she came back, would be next. And this is what Anne said to me when I talked to her about it a year later when she was living in a trailer park in a different southern town. She couldn't teach children with special needs because she couldn't provide any references from her previous employment. So she was working cleaning at a McDonald's in order to keep things going. And she said, I don't love my daughter less for mourning over this, but I miss my mom. I miss my sister. My daddy's grave is back there, and I just have to hope other people are putting flowers on it. I miss my dog. I miss my students. I feel really guilty because I'm still hung up on all this stuff that we left behind. I should just let that go. But it makes me so angry that these people have taken our lives from us. And then she said to me, you can't grieve all the time, though, when you've got your kids. You see how far they've come, and they reach you right in your heart. That moment when they come off the bus is one of my best moments. My other is when they get up in the morning and they collide on top of me. So regret? No. I miss the things that were in the old life. But if I knew this was going to happen, I would still adopt Kelly. I'm the lucky one. Because honestly, if it weren't for Kelly coming into my life, I would have never entered this bigger, more beautiful world where I've met you and so many other wonderful people. I mean, if you look at it, Kelly has brought more blessings into my life than I could possibly give back to her. I'll tell you as a sort of compliment to that story about Kim Reed, who grew up as a boy named Paul in Helena, Montana. Paul was the quarterback on the high school football team, and Kim is now a lesbian in Lower Manhattan. And she described how she left town and didn't go back for many, many years. And then she returned for her father's funeral. And then she went back for her 20th high school reunion and made a film about it, what it was like coming back to the reunion. My particular favorite moment in the film is when she's sitting on a sofa and talking to someone else from the class who says to her, but Kim, we've all changed.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features writer Andrew Solomon, whose new book is Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Kim had, in effect, the opposite experience to Anne's. Her town had missed her and welcomed her warmly. And after the film was out, she got a call one day from the pastor in her church who asked whether she would come and show the film in the church back in Helena. And she said, "I no longer live in Helena. My mom lives in Helena, so it's really up to my mom. If she wants me to, I'm happy to, and if that is not a good idea, then I won't." And her mother was very ambivalent about it, but she said the film was about Helena High School. It was going to show up in Helena somewhere, and if it came to our church, at least it would be seen by the people who know us and love us before it was seen by everyone else. And so she agreed to the showing, and they ended up making an arrangement that it would be shown at the church on Friday night of a special weekend. On Saturday, there would be seminars to discuss the content of the film, and on Sunday, Kim would be invited to preach the sermon at her church. And the film was shown. It was to a sold-out house with a long waiting list. It was then there were these discussions on Saturday. And on Sunday, Kim gave this really quite remarkable sermon, which alluded in part to the fact that her father's footage of her had been incorporated, of her when she was Paul and was a quarterback, had been incorporated into her film. And I'm going to read you a little excerpt from that sermon. "The night before last, when our film was playing in here, I went outside to the columbarium where my father's ashes rest. As I was kneeling there by what I called Dad's spot, I thought of the hours and hours of videotape that he shot lovingly of me during my football games, and how much of the same footage was now being shown inside this sanctuary. Now, it's certainly not the context that any of us expected, but I knew Dad would be proud. And just then, the dusk breeze blew in this waft of sound, and it was strangely familiar to me, and I realized it was the crosstown football game coming from the stadium. The band was playing, and the announcer was bellowing, and all of these old tapes were playing inside here on the screen, and I knew that new ones were being recorded just a few blocks away. Those recording their new memories to tape should be only so lucky as to be surprised by the last thing that they expected from their loved ones, only so fortunate as to get a chance to welcome them home with radical love. I thought about how all these cycles of lives would continue on, and so many aspects of my life coalesced in that one moment, that one beautiful, stunning, blessed moment, the past and the present, parent and child, male and female, the pain that life sometimes brings, and the soothing love that welcomes it with open arms after its exhausting journey into a distant country. And I said to Kim's mother, 'Do you wish it hadn't happened? Do you wish Paul had been content to be Paul?' And she said, 'Well, of course I do. That would have been easier for Paul and easier for everyone. But the point is, he wasn't happy to be Paul. And I can't imagine the courage it took. And look what we got. Kim,' she said." My last sort of anecdote from the book that I'll tell you was about an interview which was perhaps the most emotionally overwhelming of all that I did, which was with the parents of Dylan Klebold, who was one of the perpetrators of the Columbine massacre. They had resisted talking to me for a long time, and they finally agreed to have a conversation, and I went out to do a brief interview. And they were so full of their story once they started telling it that we recorded 20 hours of interviews in the course of 3 days. And on Sunday night, we were all dropping with exhaustion, and we were sitting in the kitchen, and Sue was fixing dinner, Sue Klebold. And I said, "If Dylan were here now, what would you want to ask him?" And his father said, "I'd want to ask him what the hell he thought he was doing." And his mother sort of looked at the floor, and she thought for a minute. And then she said, "I would ask him to forgive me for being his mother and never knowing what was going on inside his head." And a couple of years later, she and I were having dinner together in Denver. And she said, "You know, when it first happened, I used to wish I had never gone to Ohio State. I had never met Tom. I had never had children. They wouldn't have existed, and this terrible thing wouldn't have happened. But over time, I've come to feel that I love the children I had so much that I don't want to imagine a life without them, even at the cost of this pain." When I say that, I'm talking about my own pain, of course, not the pain of other people. But life is full of suffering, and this is mine. So while I know that it would have been better for the world if Dylan had never been born, I've decided that it would not have been better for me. And I kept wondering how it could be that all of these parents over and over again expressed this sense that they would never exchange the children they had for any other children. The parents of dwarfs, the parents of criminals, the parents of people who were transgender, the parents of people who were autistic. How could it be that they had come to this point of saying, I might like to help my child to suffer less, I might like to fix some things, I might like to make things smoother, but not to sort of feel ultimately, but what a disappointment that I had the child I had. And I don't want to go light on the pain of these experiences because the pain, as I think you know from what I've described, the pain was very real and the pain was a big part of what they'd experienced. And then I thought, yet all of us who have children who are flawed in some way. And if some glorious angel suddenly burst through my living room ceiling and offered to take my children away and give me other children who are more attractive and intelligent and polite than the ones I have, I would cling to my children and pray away that atrocious spectacle. And I really came to think of the old chestnut that we don't only take care of our children because we love them, but also love them because we take care of them. And the process of caretaking is actually a very intimate process. Indeed, it's one of the engines of true intimacy. These children required so much care, so much attention, so much understanding. That could be very taxing, it could be very difficult, and in the instant it could make people furious and exhausted. But it also created very deep and inviolable bonds. Not for everyone. Some people have disabled children and give them up for adoption or abandon or neglect them. And I have a few of those people in the book itself. There's not really space for them in the talk. But still, at some profound and fundamental level, the attachment is a kind of permanent attachment. And in the same way that we look at these people with difference, we look in the end at our own children, all of whom have some differences from us. I have yet to meet anyone who has not occasionally looked at his child and said, "What planet did you come from?" And I remembered two things that people I interviewed had said. One was a woman whose child, who had very severe multiple disabilities, had died tragically through caregiver neglect. And at the internment of his ashes, she said, "Let me bury here the rage I feel to have been twice robbed. Once of the child I wanted, and once of the son I loved." Another woman said to me, "People always regale us with these little sayings like, 'God doesn't give you any more than you can handle.' But children like ours are not preordained as a gift. They're a gift because that's what we have chosen." And that resonated very strongly with the rest of what I looked like, the sense that all of these parents had ended up in some way grateful for lives they would have done anything to avoid. The overarching supposition of my book is that each of the kinds of difference I looked at is individually quite isolating. There are only so many families dealing with schizophrenia or criminality or transgenderism, only so many families of prodigies, because positive difference is also very difficult to deal with, even if it's more joyful than some of these other conditions. There are only so many families dealing with all of these different manifestations of difference. And yet, if you posit, as I do, that the experience they have of bringing up children who are different gives them something in common, then suddenly, instead of being in a bunch of small minorities, they join hands and are in a large majority. And that was really the message that I felt I was telling, is that our negotiation of difference is what unites us. It's the most common experience of parenting. It's fundamental to all parenting. It exists in all of these different contexts. It's not the thing that cuts you off from everyone else, as it so often seems to be. And I ended up thinking that the integration of all of these kinds of difference is incredibly valuable. Before I began on this book, I thought that if I had children and they got into the education system and they were in a classroom where there was mainstreaming of disabled children into their classrooms, it was something I would put up with because I knew it was good for the disabled children, but always with a sense of loss that my children weren't going to learn their times tables as quickly as I thought they should. And after working on this book, I really felt that being exposed to people who are different stretches our humanity, and it's my hope that my children will be in classrooms with children who are different enough so that they will have to have a broad and encompassing idea of what it means to be human, and they can catch up on the multiplication in between times. I decided to have children while I was working on this book, and people said to me, how can you possibly have decided to have children in the middle of a book about everything that can go wrong? And I said, it's not really a book about everything that can go wrong. It's a book about how much love there can be even when everything seems to be going wrong. The structure of my family is that my husband is the biological father of two children with some lesbian friends in Minneapolis. One of my best friends from college had been through a divorce but felt she would like to have children, and so she and I have a daughter, and mother and daughter live in Fort Worth, Texas. And then my husband and I wanted to bring up a child full-time in our house, and so we have a son of whom I am the biological father, and we had an egg donor, and our surrogate for the pregnancy was Laura, the lesbian mother of my husband's two biological children. So the shorthand is five parents of four children in three states. And there are people out there who believe that the existence of families such as mine somehow damages or undermines the vitality of families such as theirs. And I don't subscribe to those subtractive models of love, only additive ones. And I believe that in the same way we need species diversity to sustain the planet, we need this diversity of kinds of affection to sustain the ecosphere of kindness. And I felt very passionately about that. And our son was born, and the day after he was born, the pediatrician came in and said that she was concerned. She said he wasn't extending his legs correctly, which could possibly indicate that he had some form of brain damage. She said insofar as he was extending them, he was doing so asymmetrically, which was suggestive of a possible mass or tumor in his brain, and that he had a very large head and should be tested for hydrocephalus. And I felt my whole being spilling out on the floor, and I thought, here I am in the throes of a book about how much meaning people have found in the experience of bringing up children who are disabled or different in some way, and I passionately don't want to join their number. And I felt the impulse, which I think all parents feel, to protect this child who is my child. And we went off to the CAT scanner and the MRI machine and the arterial blood draw that we had to do and so on and so forth all over the hospital, hour after hour. And the day felt so heavy, and I thought to myself, what will I do? And I felt despair, because what I was experiencing was that my child had an illness. And yet in the back of my mind, there was a knowledge that came out of what I'd done, that if he had any of the conditions we were testing for, they would become his identity. And if they became his identity, they would become my identity. And I looked at him strapped into those machines, and I felt so uncomforting, as when he's unable to comfort someone one has only met a few hours before, as I watched him. And yet, as I wished for him to be well, for himself and for me, the line kept ringing through the back of my mind, where my mother had said, "The love for your children is unlike any other feeling in the world. And until you have children, you don't know what it feels like." So we had 5 hours of testing, and then the pediatrician called us in and told us that all the scans were clear and added that he was now extending his legs exactly the right way. And I asked her what she thought had been going on in the morning, and she said he had probably had a cramp. Children had ensnared me one way or another as soon as I connected fatherhood and loss. But I probably wouldn't have noticed that if I hadn't been in the throes of my book. I had encountered so much strange love. I fell into its bewitching patterns. I saw how splendor could illuminate even these strangest intimacies. I realized that while I had been writing, I had often thought that the families I was interviewing were fools, enslaving themselves to a lifetime's journey with these thankless children and trying to breed identity out of misery. But that day in the hospital with George, I realized that my research had built me a plank and that I was ready to join them on their ship. Thank you very much. Thank you.
I don't know about you, but I'm totally verklempt. Okay. Who has a question?
So, of course, I want to thank you. And just to say, as a parent of a child who's very different, it's wonderful that you've defined me as a parent of a child who's really different, not as a parent of a child with learning differences or a parent of an adopted child, but in a broader context. I'm very curious to what extent the parents you interviewed had thought of these questions a lot and to what extent you felt like you were asking them things they hadn't thought about.
It was really a mixed bag on that front. There were some people who I went to see who had considered the ramifications of their situation and could articulate it in the first hour that we spent together. And there are people in the book. There's this whole story of a family. I met the family once. I recorded 2.5 hours of a conversation. That was it. The Klebolds, I think in the end we had something like 300 hours of tapes that I was going through to tell their story. Not actually because they hadn't thought about it, but because it was so complicated and so difficult for them to tell. There were a number of families like that. And there were a number of families who said after we had talked about their situation, they said, you know, even if you end up not using my story, this process has felt to me like a kind of therapy. The questions that you've asked have ultimately been very liberating for me. And I was glad when people said that. There's the idea, I think, that the journalist goes in and is completely neutral and has no effect on what he's examining. And I felt like if I was going to impinge on the pain and difficulty that these people had endured, I wanted to offer them some emotional response by way of support for that. And in a few cases, I didn't give anyone financial help, but I actually put people in touch with service agencies, or I told them that they had legal rights they weren't aware of. I tried to be helpful to them if I could be, because I saw the amount of pain that they were in. And the reason I was able to do that in many instances was because I had met other families who actually knew what their legal rights were or who knew what kind of services they should get. And so I was kind of translating from the more enfranchised parents to the less enfranchised ones. What I found, which was surprising in some ways, though perhaps it shouldn't have been, is that I had assumed that the people who were the most educated, who had the most power, who had the most money, were the ones who would have the most understanding of what was going on and be able to speak about it best. And sometimes that was true, but sometimes those people had put up walls around them, which they were able to sustain by virtue of everything they had, and they really didn't see things very clearly, or they didn't accept the difficult aspects of their reality. And I found, conversely, that there were people who seemed extremely disempowered and weak and poor, who I would have thought would have had a hard time grasping the complexities, who actually spoke with the sort of clarity of an arrow flying through the air about exactly what their situation was and exactly what they'd done. And some of the time I found that the capacity for the acceptance that the book is ultimately really about was greater in people who had not grown up believing that problems could always be fixed and changed, and that getting to that point of acceptance was much harder for people whose basic model was to fix everything and who had always assumed that was possible. So it was a galvanizing experience to encounter those discontinuities. And I think that's the last question, but I'll be signing books and happy to talk to you all some more.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was writer Andrew Solomon, whose new book is Far From the Tree: Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia and Chris Howell. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I invite you to tune in again next Thursday at noon when Bina will feature former CIA operative and author Robert Baer. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.